It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a public health problem facing senior citizens, injuries from falling, and we'll talk about how to prevent them.
First, President Obama spoke at the United Nations General Assembly this morning and fired back at Russian President Vladimir Putin's assertion that the United States is not exceptional.
The president said he believes the U.S. is exceptional, and he defended the role America has played in international affairs.
Well, is the U.S. truly exceptional? Should we have a strong role in the conflicts of other countries? Our guest says no. Joining us now is Christopher Preble, Vice President of Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Christopher, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we said, President Obama spoke at the UN today, insisted on this idea of American exceptionalism, the idea that the U.S. has a greater responsibility on the world stage than other countries. Now, it's not a new concept of America. Do you think it's still the right position for America today?
Well, I think it really depends on what we mean by exceptional. I certainly think this country is exceptional. I think most Americans feel that way, and it's become sort of a catchphrase to criticize either the president or his critics at different times. But it's really what sort of exceptionalism. You know, the founders of this country envisioned it as a city on a hill, a model to be emulated, one that that would show other countries how to build a good society, build a thriving economy, protect the rights and privileges of its citizens, and expect that that model would inspire others to follow our lead. Somewhere along the line in American history, most people date it to the turn of the 20th century, we became more of a crusader state, that is, someone, a country that would go around the world and try to promote this idea, not as a model to be emulated, but actually actively trying to promote it. And I think we see, we see, especially after the Iraq and Afghanistan, quite a bit of unhappiness, frankly, and dissatisfaction among the American people with trying to do this by force. We've learned that it doesn't work very well. We've learned that it isn't always appreciated. And ultimately, I think we've learned that it isn't really necessary for our security at the end of the day.
Well, seen from one example, it's exceptionalism, as you just defined it originally, being sort of a model, mm-hmm. a beacon on the hill, as you said. But seen in other lights, the U.S. can be seen as a watchdog or as a lone wolf. And we do have other bodies of governance now on the world stage. The U.N., for instance, is one of these. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the question is, how does the U.S., see itself in light of changes in the world and how governance is run these days?
Well, the UN is still a collection of sovereign states. So at the end of the day, the members, each individual member in the UN is prepared or is considers how they will respond based on their own interests, based on the support back at home, based on their own laws. The United States, in that respect, is no different. We have a system of laws. We have certain rules governing when, for example, the United States deploys forces abroad. And I think we saw, especially in the case of Syria, that in a representative democracy, the people have a voice. The people's representatives last month made quite clear they were not willing to support the use of the force in Syria as the president proposed. And so we're left with something else, that is other countries being encouraged to do more and step up, with the United States still playing an important role, but not expected to play the only role. And I think that was one of the key lessons to take away from what happened with respect to the Syria case.
Does that mean that Americans, you think, are a little fatigued with the notion of exceptionalism, especially if it's America in there all by itself?
Yes, in the sense that they don't want America to be in there all by ourselves. Certainly, if our core interests are at stake, if our security is threatened, then we are prepared to act unilaterally even. It would be our preference, however, to have allies who are cooperating with us, providing some of the forces or at least supporting us diplomatically and financially along the way. That's, that kind of the next best scenario. But in the case of Syria, you didn't even have that, or it's a very belated and very begrudging. Some of the states in the region were willing to support us, but not in a very meaningful way. And I think that's why the American people were, on top of everything else, on top of their general fatigue, were particularly disinterested in intervening there.
Well, Russia provided us with a kind of plan B, President Obama, I should say, with a plan B in terms right. of intervening in Syria. But that chapter of the book is not closed by any means. And at the right. UN, President Obama still said, you know, he hoped that if things didn't go as agreed upon, if Syria didn't surrender the chemical weapons, then we would need to intervene. And I'm wondering what you think about how receptive the UN and other countries will be if that's the case.
Well, it's been a very uneven track record, let's be honest. You know, there have been some uses of force that have been sanctioned by the UN Security Council, most recently against Libya. But I think even the experience in Libya is a bit of a cautionary tale for some member states. You know, that operation was supposed to be designed merely to protect the population in the city of Benghazi, but then it was used as a justification for ultimately overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi, and, you know, he ultimately was killed in the process. And since then, Libya is not exactly a model of stability and security in the region. So I think that given that experience, there's going to be considerable resistance at the UN to sanctioning the use of force as the ultimate punishment. Not that it would be impossible, but that it will just be a harder sell for those who want that kind of a formal sanction by the UN.
Well, in terms of Iran as well, that's another thing that President Obama indicated that the U.S. is watching closely and, you know, is hopeful about the outcome there. But what do you think will happen in terms of the United States having a responsibility to intervene again should Iran proceed with development of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think that to the extent that the multilateral sanctions, and it really is a broad-based effort, have clearly had an impact on the Iranian economy. They've made it difficult for Iran to use the international banking system. It's clearly had an effect on the people of Iran. It's not surprising that the government there is trying to come up with ways to ease those sanctions. And one way might be to enter into negotiations in exchange for relaxing the sanctions. The problem is that, as I see it, is that here in the United States, here in Washington, there's much less willingness. There's a lot of willingness to talk about increasing sanctions or increasing penalty. There's much less willingness to talk about what could the Iranians do in a concrete way that would result in the United States lessening those sanctions or easing those sanctions. In other words, I haven't heard many people here in Washington talk about what would be accepting yes for an answer. We hear a lot about what the Iranians are not supposed to be doing, but not a lot about what the United States is willing to forego in exchange for the Iranians meeting some of their commitments.
Now, in that opinion piece that ran last week by Vladimir Putin that, you know, provided the backdrop for the United States to sort of backpedal on the red line against Syria. Mm-hmm. At the end of that piece, Putin had a little paragraph about, you know, the time of American exceptionalism is over and we're all sort of this, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was sort of we're all citizens of the world.
Right.
One country is not exceptional and another unexceptional, and that this notion, you know, is sort of dated. What did you make of that? And how do you think that was received internationally?
Well, I can't speak to internationally, but it really is pretty absurd. You know, Vladimir Putin is the president of a country that its entire economy is about the size of the Iberian Peninsula, and Russia is literally dying. They have a demographic problem because their life expectancy is shrinking and their population is shrinking. So the notion of Vladimir Putin speaking as though he were the leader of a world power is really quite absurd. It would be a little different if leader of China, for example, or leader of some of the other truly growing and dynamic economies in the world made that charge. But even they would have a very kind of thin argument to make. After all, the United States is still overwhelmingly dominant in terms of its military power, its economic power. Even though we account for just about 5% of the world's population, we still account for about 25% of its wealth and about 45% of its military spending. So, you know, again, we can define exceptionalism lots of different ways. I think we shouldn't narrowly define it as our ability to fight and win wars. I think it's the other things that make us truly exceptional and worth celebrating. I don't take my many lessons from Vladimir Putin, and frankly, I don't think many Americans do. But equally important, I don't think many people elsewhere in the world follow Vladimir Putin's guidance or listen to what Russia has to say these days.
But given the case you just laid out, the reasons that America can be seen as exceptional, I mean, to kind of borrow from the Spider-Man adage, with great power comes great responsibility. I mean, is that true of the United States right now?
It has been, and I think it's something I've written about quite a bit in my life. You know, I think we built up this military power, and it really goes back to the end of World War II and the Cold War. We built up this military power. We were defending countries that were badly broken by war and warfare, shattered physically but also emotionally, psychologically. These countries have since recovered, recovered spectacularly. They are wealthy. They are safe. And the time has come for other countries to step forward and to do a bit more, certainly in their own defense, but also to defend common interests. The good news is we have many other allies around the world that do share our interests. What we don't have, unfortunately, is allies with the capabilities and the willingness to use them. And I think that's where we really need to be moving as a country. Precisely because of what I just said, while it's true that we account for about 25% of the world's wealth, that percentage is declining, and we're not going to be able to sustain, at least not indefinitely, maintain, you know, being the world's policeman without anyone contributing anything, at least to their own security and ideally to global challenges.
All right, we'll leave it there. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Chris Preble, Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute.
Coming up, we'll check the news. Then we're talking about a public health issue, preventing injuries from falling, especially for senior citizens. This is Central Time.